Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. The UN Human Rights Office says South Sudan's government has operated a scorched-earth policy of killing, raping, and looting civilians as it fights rebels in the country's civil war. A new report released Friday says all parties in the conflict have committed serious and systematic violence against civilians, but says state actors bore the greatest responsibility during 2015 as opposition forces grew weaker. The report describes a multitude of human rights violations. The scale of sexual violence is particularly shocking, the Human Rights Office said in a statement. Between April and September 2015, the UN recorded more than 1,300 rapes in just one of the country's 10 states. The report contains accounts of civilians believed to support the opposition being burned to death, shot, hanged from trees, or cut to pieces. Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos, one of Africa's longest ruling leaders, said Friday he will quit politics in 2018 following the end of his current term. Dos Santos, who has led Angola since 1979, has hinted at retiring before but always remained in office. A spokesman for the opposition UNITA party said Friday that the party will believe dos Santos is stepping down when they see it. The president is nearing the end of a five-year term that began when his party won the August 2012 general election. Last year, he announced the next elections will take place in August 2017. In his speech Friday, dos Santos did not say why he intends to retire and did not name a potential successor. Please look at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Radical Islam, foreign policy, and trade were among a range of issues tackled in a mostly civil debate between the last four U.S. Republican presidential candidates ahead of next Tuesday's key primary and caucus contests. On dealing with the threat posed by radicalized Muslims, the distinctions on their approaches were clear, beginning with Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
We're going to have to work with the Jordanian kingdom. We're going to have to work with the Saudis. We're going to have to work with the Gulf kingdoms. We're going to have to work with the Egyptians to defeat, for example, ISIS. It will take a Sunni Arab movement to defeat them.
Trump's closest rival in the contest so far, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, is the self-described alternative to Donald Trump's extremes in the race. Cruz criticized Trump's proposal to impose hefty trade tariffs on countries that do not cooperate with the United States. If Rubio loses to Trump in his home state, it would be a huge embarrassment and could mean the end of his campaign. Polls going into Thursday's debate showed Trump on top in Florida, followed by Rubio and Cruz. Polls also indicate Trump beating Ohio Governor John Kasich in Ohio. In Myanmar's lower house of parliament Friday, Tin Jaw, an unelected retired bureaucrat from the National League for Democracy, trounced the country's incumbent vice president, Salma Khom, in first-round balloting to move a step closer to the presidency. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is in the capital, Naypyidaw, and speaks about Tin Jaw.
He is quite well-known. General Min Swe is the chief minister for the Yangon region, quite a hardliner. And while he is certain to lose the parliamentary vote for president, he is guaranteed at least to be the second vice president. So Aung San Suu Kyi is not going to be able to have everything her way because she will have a second VP, a hardliner general. And the military, of course, has one-fourth of the seats in the parliament reserved for those in uniform.
Steve Herman in that piece was speaking about the incumbent vice president, Salma Khom. Macedonia's president says his country has been forced to pay for the actions of the European Union in the current migrant crisis, arguing that the influx has cost Macedonia $28 million so far. In an interview published Friday in the German newspaper Bild, George Ivanov said Macedonia is fed up with the situation after having to declare a national crisis. He complained that the European Union has not contributed a cent to Macedonia's expenses and said the trade bloc has completely lost sight of security concerns. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
a new United Nations report accuses South Sudanese soldiers and affiliated militias of using mass rape as a weapon of terror and of employing a scorched earth policy against the civilian population.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from the launch of the report by the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva. Details next.
Also in the news, Tunisian President Baji Kaid Essebsi says extremists now pose a security threat to his country. And in the north of Nigeria, regional military efforts have weakened Boko Haram and prevented many large-scale attacks.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas and Puga, sitting in for Sunny, music from Mali and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a new United Nations report accuses South Sudanese soldiers and affiliated militias of using mass rape as a weapon of terror and of employing a scorched earth policy against the civilian population. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report by the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva.
The report calls the scale and type of sexual violence committed primarily by government SPLA and allied militias one of the most horrendous human rights situations in the world. During the period of the report from April to September 2015, the UN recorded 1,300 reported rapes in oil-rich Unity State alone. The report says sexual assaults are carried out with extreme brutality. It finds girls and women of all ages are subjected to multiple gang rapes. Some are then killed, while others are abducted and held in sexual slavery as so-called wives for soldiers in barracks. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA that youth militia allied to the government are being allowed to rape women in lieu of wages.
It seems they're not being paid. They're just being given carte blanche to rape and to steal cattle. And then basically those are the two sort of bits of war bounty they get, the women and the cattle. It's really an unbelievable picture, and then nothing being done, apparently, by the government to stop it.
Colville says the government received the report 1 week ago and has more or less denied some of the worst allegations. He says the prevalence of rape and the deliberate and systematic way in which it is being carried out indicates that rape is being used as a weapon of war and as a means of terrorizing the civilian population. That policy seems to be working, he says, as more than 2 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes since South Sudan's civil war began in December 2013. He says government forces and the militias have been systematically destroying the towns and villages abandoned by the people across southern and central Unity State.
Massive destruction when you know, one group captures another group's town, destroy three-quarters sometimes or more of the buildings. And, you know, what appears to be a sort of concerted effort to sort of, you know, employ scorched earth policy so they don't come back.
Colville says these horrific violations could likely amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity, given how widespread and systematic they are. He warns the deliberate targeting of civilians for killing, rape, and pillage will continue until people are held accountable and punished for the crimes they commit. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Tunisia, a spokesman for the country's counter-terrorism forces says at least 22 militants killed during attacks on the border town of Ben Gourdain were Tunisian nationals. It appears a majority of the Islamic State fighters who attacked the town had been either hiding or residing there prior to the assaults. However, it's suspected they had been trained in neighboring Libya. One analyst says the attacks on Ben Gourdain were made to test Tunisian security forces, but it appears residents joined security forces in repelling the attacks, indicating there was no local support for Islamic State there. However, the analysts say the attacks did expose some weak points along the border. Meanwhile, in Libya, the National Salvation Government has ordered its agencies to be on alert for any Islamic State activity. This includes searching vehicles, abandoned buildings, and homes of foreign workers.
The attacks this week on the Tunisian town of Ben Gourdain targeted a police station and military sites. Tunisian President Baji Kaid Essebsi says extremists now pose a security threat to his country. He says the goal of the Islamic State attacks were probably to take control of the area and create a new emirate for the group. Our senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi discussed the threat with Radwan Masoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunis. He asked him whether there's evidence that Islamic State is indeed attempting to create a stronghold in Tunisia.
There is plenty of evidence that this attack has been planned for several months, and the plan was to take over the village or small town of Ben Gourdain on the border with Libya. If you remember, the U.S. Attacked a base in Libya maybe 2-3 weeks ago, and it was a base full of Tunisians who belonged to Daesh, to ISIS, and who were planning for this attack. And I think that helped to reduce the number of attackers on Ben Gourdain. And as a result, the people who came to attack in Ben Gourdain were only about 100 instead of the 200 originally planned for the attack to take over Ben Gourdain. But it's clear that the attack was very big and intended to take over Ben Gourdain. And I think they were trying to replicate what ISIS has done in Syria and in Iraq by taking over entire cities and basically holding the people of that city as hostage. So then the army cannot take back the city, because if the army were to take back the city, it would have to kill a lot of civilians. So the plan was big, but I think the Tunisian army and the Tunisian security services were ready for the attack and defeated it very quickly in a few hours. And this is a major victory against terrorism and against ISIS.
So what kind of measures are being taken to protect Tunisia against such attacks and such terrorist threats?
As we know, the problem is that Libya has become basically without any government and without any security system in place. And we know that ISIS and Daesh controls about 200 kilometer stretch on the sea in Libya, and are actually very close to Tunisia in some towns that are only 50 to 60 kilometers from Tunisia. So the military in Tunisia are very vigilant and are trying to control the border very, very carefully, especially that the West and NATO are talking about further attacks against ISIS and Daesh in Libya, which means that more and more of these people will try to escape to Tunisia. And there is talk now in Tunisia of closing the border with Libya, at least temporarily for a few months, in order to prevent these terrorists from coming to Tunisia.
Tunisia is trying to re-energize its economy, especially the tourism sector. How do security threats negatively impact the Tunisian economy?
As we know, terrorism exists everywhere. You know, this is a major threat for the whole world. I think the Tunisian security and the Tunisian army have improved tremendously and have strengthened their training and their equipment, and they are much more ready to handle these threats very effectively and very quickly. And we've seen a lot of progress in that regard. But tourism remains a very important sector in Tunisia, and we have almost 400,000 people who work in the tourism sector. And so if the tourism sector suffers, the whole of Tunisian economy is going to suffer, and this will have a very, very negative impact on the economy, and especially on the number of unemployed people, and therefore could become a serious threat to the democratic transition in Tunisia.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunis. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
For more than 6 years, Boko Haram militants have terrorized the villages and cities in the mostly Muslim north of Nigeria. Regional military efforts have weakened the group and prevented many large-scale attacks. But now Boko Haram often resorts to suicide bombings and still launches smaller raids. Nevertheless, one of the first cities to report it has reclaimed its streets from militants is the nation's second largest city, Kano. Reporter Abubakar Harun Galadanchi says much of the credit goes to local action and the leadership of the Emir of Kano, a powerful religious leader who 2 years ago was suspended as head of Nigeria's central bank after reporting corruption. Galadanchi spoke to VOA's David Arnold from Kano.
The security situation in Kano is good because before, if we can recall, 7 to 10 months back, there are so many roadblocks for policemen, but due to the stabilizing of security situation here in Kano, all those attacks that the Boko Haram people used to carry out from day to day, either in the day or in the night, I can tell you all this has been in history because all those roadblocks, they have already disappeared. The policemen and even the soldiers has already recalled back to their bases due to stability of the security in Kano.
Have you had experience with any suicide bombings in Kano?
In the last 15 months, there's nothing like suicide bombing in Kano. The issue of Boko Haram, it was started exactly 6 years, 3 months now, where it started from Borno State, that is Maiduguri. Later, it was escalated to states like Yobe, Adamawa, and later even here in Kano, where some years back the Kano State people witnessed so many bomb blasts, killing, and so many deadly things which carried out by Boko Haram. But thank God for now, the Kano State security situation is normal due to some measures taken by Kano State Police Command with Kano State Emirate Council and other dignitaries in Kano.
The Emir of Kano previously was director of the central bank in Abuja.
Exactly.
He is now the Emir. What has his role been in the issues of security of Kano State?
The Emir of Kano, Alhaji Muhammad Sanusi II, has been exactly 1 year and 9 months he's been an Emir of Kano State. Before, he's a governor of Central Bank of Nigeria, where later they have a problem with the federal government during the presidency of Goodluck Ebele Jonathan. And when he came back to Kano, since he's from the Emirate Council, immediately the former Kano State Emir died, so he was appointed as an Emir. Actually, sincerely speaking, he has done a lot towards making sure that Kano State, for the issue of Boko Haram that terrorized the lives of Kano State people.
He is a religious or spiritual leader of the north, but does he have government responsibilities as well?
The Kano Emirate Council has some powers. I can tell you, the Kano State Emir is among the top people that government, they want to do something directly. He is the one that will talk to people directly. I can tell you, Kano State people, even the northern Nigeria people, used to obey.
That was reporter Abubakar Harun Galadanchi in Kano. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold in Washington.
Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Reports from far northern Cameroon say two suspected Boko Haram suicide bombers attacked a cattle market today in Homeka. However, security forces are quoted as saying the only victims were the bombers. It appears they detonated their bombs after being discovered by vigilante forces.
Music. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland says the United States is increasing the number of Syrian refugees that it will take in. Speaking in Athens, Nuland said the U.S. is working with Greece, Turkey, and other countries to end hostilities in Syria and support the U.N. resettlement process. The Assistant Secretary of State also visited the overcrowded camp at Idomeni on the Greek-Macedonian border. There's word today that Greek authorities hope to close that camp in the coming weeks and resettle the thousands of people there. Reporter Philip Warwick is in Idomeni and has been following the plight of the migrants and refugees. He spoke today to VOA's Jody Capua about what Greek authorities plan to do with the camp.
They're hoping to empty the camp within the next 2 weeks and slowly actually persuade the refugees and the migrants to nearby government-built shelters. The Deputy Minister for Public Order, his name is Nikos Toskas, said that it is a huge task and moving 14,000 people won't obviously take place in a week. 2 weeks is a preliminary idea in terms of moving people out. That's just a preliminary idea. They have to persuade to move them out. They can't use, for example, force or tear gas because obviously that will just have a counteractive effect. Because, and also we need to take into consideration that about two-thirds of the camp is occupied by women and children. About 800 people from the camp have moved out, but obviously more are arriving daily. The Greek government, besides moving them out, is building 50 new resettlement centres. However, there are a number of Greeks and Syrians who do not want to leave the refugee camp because they've been here for the past 3 weeks, and they're prepared to wait longer. Yesterday, what I saw was about 100 to 150 people leave the Idomeni refugee camp. Well, they were taken by coach to resettlement camps in and around Athens. There have been relocation leaflets with geographical locations, which have been handed out to camp refugees. On Wednesday, you had 2,000 refugees arrive on the Greek island of Lesbos, and there is a trickle of refugees arriving to the refugee camp every day, but not the same numbers, not the same thousands that we saw over the last 2 weeks.
But the refugees don't want to stay in Greece. The Macedonian border is closed. Apparently, the plans are to relocate the refugees and migrants to resettlement camps within Greece. Obviously, they want to get to the Balkans, and they're closing those routes. So really, what could the outcome be in the coming weeks for these folks?
Just to recap, as you said, Macedonia will no longer let any migrants through the Greek border. And the border has been closed since Sunday. So there has been no movement whatsoever. In terms of the Balkan route, the problem is that countries, including Austria, so we're talking about Serbia, Macedonia, Croatia, what we've seen are unilateral decisions in terms of border crossing. The border crossing, for example, here between Greece and Macedonia has not been coordinated with humanitarian organizations on the ground and with Greece. So that's why we're seeing this chaos on the border. No one's communicating also with the refugees. They don't know what's happening. They don't know if the border is open or closed. I'm still getting questions, is the border open or will it be open? They don't know who will be allowed to cross the border. The information is not going through the humanitarian NGOs, and the Balkan countries are not telling the humanitarian NGOs. If there was more information passed on to the refugees, they would actually know their options and probably make more of an informed decision in terms of either to stay in the camp or hope for the best, because you still have thousands basically hoping for the best.
Now, of course, it's been raining a lot in recent days. What about today?
Today hasn't been too bad, actually. Morning, sun with blue skies. It started to drizzle, but that stopped. The rain that we've had over the past 3 days and nights, there are still sections, parts of the camp, which are badly swamped in rainwater. And it leaves the impression that some of the tents were either floating in water or sinking in mud. What I was able to observe were men building drainage systems with shovels, with knives, with even stones to reroute the water around the tents.
And one last question. You've been among the migrants and refugees. What's the mood like? Are they holding out hope that their life will eventually get better?
A couple of days ago, there were voices of, why have we come here? It was perhaps better to stay in Syria, to stay with our loved ones, stay with our families, and die with them. I think there was a moment where the despair and the misery peaked. Now, since we've seen movement and this relocation, resettlement program on behalf of the Greek government and also the UN, this information is filtering very slowly to the refugees, and they're seeing other options.
That's reporter Philip Warwick in the Greek town of Idomeni. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. The EU holds another summit next week on the crisis. The outcome could affect the migrants and refugees in Greece.
Cameroon, a new book by an imprisoned former government minister has sparked heated debate. The book's author, along with some fellow politicians and rights activists, say the government is using its crackdown on corruption as a pretext to target potential political rivals of longtime President Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinzaga reports from Yaoundé.
At least 24 former government officials have been arrested in Cameroon in the past 8 years. They include several ex-ministers and heads of state-owned corporations. The roundup has become known locally as Operation Sparrowhawk, referring to a predator that hunts and eats other smaller birds. Ex-health minister Uben Olangena Awono says he and other detainees are prisoners of conscience in his book published Monday, March 7. The book is titled Mensonges d'État, or Lies of the State. Other detainees have published letters in local media recently saying their arrest and long detentions are politically motivated. Cameroon's government spokesman, Issa Chiruma Bakari, held a press conference Thursday to respond.
Nous entendons parler depuis quelque temps de persécution ou de prisonniers politiques sous le
He says people have been erroneously accusing the government of witch hunting, abuse of legal procedures and political persecution, whereas the president is simply asking those arrested to account for public funds. He says Paul Biya is not and will never be afraid of political competition to the level that he arrests his opponents. Bakari also told reporters that detained officials were plotting to challenge state authority. Awono is serving a 20-year jail sentence. He was arrested and convicted of corruption and embezzlement in 2008, the same year Biya changed the constitution so he could run for 2 more terms in office. Local press had reported at the time that Awono and his senior staff were plotting to oust Biya. Awono's defense counsel, Barrister Andrew Litumbe, says that is not true.
Paul Biya is like, I cannot even term him a dictator. He's a super dictator.
Last year, Cameroon's Justice Minister, Laurent Esso, said $4 million of public funds had so far been recovered, though he did not give further details. The state estimates as much as $152 million in public funds has been stolen. Cameroonian law states that corruption suspects can be detained and have travel documents seized while investigations are ongoing. At least 4 corruption detainees have died in prison. Family members told VOA they did not receive proper medical attention. Human rights activist Robert Mbile says only 15 of the ex-officials arrested since 2008 have been charged with anything.
It is in rare countries like Cameroon where you find a president who is the head of the armed forces, the judiciary, government, and everything. So he is even a supra. He's a supra president. He appoints the judges. Even the Constitutional Council, he has to lord on it. Biya has been taking care only of his chair and nothing else. The interest of the people is nothing to him.
The government says lengthy judicial procedures and difficulties tracing embezzled funds in foreign banks have made investigations cumbersome and long. Biya's mandate ends in 2018, but his supporters have been calling publicly on the 83-year-old leader to organize elections sooner and run again. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Ihe Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next, right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
this is Peter Clote, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A new United Nations report accuses South Sudanese soldiers and affiliate militias of using mass rape as a weapon of terror. Tunisia's president says extremists now pose a security threat to his country. And in Nigeria, regional military efforts have weakened Boko Haram and prevented many large-scale attacks. Coming up, we'll have music from Mali. And in our feature report, Sony Music Entertainment recently announced the opening of a new office in Lagos. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Ruhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga, who's been sitting in all week for Sunny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. And what's on tap today?
We start off Africa football. Thank you
Sounds
very much.
Good.
Yes. Africa football is getting a boost as former English Premier League club managers Martin Joel and Alex McNish launch African Champions League careers this weekend with Egyptian giants Al Ahly and Zamalek, respectively. Dutchman Joel has taken his Ahly side to Angola for a last 32 clash with Recreative Libolo on Saturday, while Scott McLeish has travelled with Zamalek to Cameroon for a Sunday showdown against Union Douala. The games are among the round of 32 first legs, with Tipi Mazembe of the DR Congo starting a title defence at St. George of Ethiopia under a new French coach, Hubert Velud. Ahly are hunting a record-extending ninth championship under the 60-year-old former Tottenham Hotspur and Fulham boss Joel. Alex McLeish hopes to win silverware, while Ahly had a preliminary round by Libolo Trance Racing of Equatorial Guinea 9-1 on aggregate, with Senegalese Mamadou Diawara scoring 4 goals and Luis Luciano Silva 3. Joel has included two foreigners, strikers Malik Evona of Gabon and John Antwi of Ghana, in a 20-man Red Devils squad. McLeish is reported to have said that he's relishing the chance to win trophies at Zamalek after years of battling relegation in England with Birmingham City and neighbours Aston Villa. Zamalek lost their first domestic match under McLeish, but bounced back to beat Arab contractors in Cairo last weekend. Velud, who has coached in Morocco and Algeria, replaced compatriot Patrice Cateron after Mazembe flopped at the 2015 FIFA Club World Cup in Japan, finishing second.
If you would like to leave a voicemail for possible use on a future Sunny Side of Sports broadcast, please call 1-202-205-9942. Once again, that number, 1-202-205-9942.
VOA!
When you hear the VOA identification, press 60, and please include your name and where you are calling from.
Voice of America!
Hello, this is Magnus Chisholm calling from Imo State in Nigeria. I love listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. It's always a daily delight of listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. Once again, Magnus Chisholm on with you calling from Imo State in Nigeria and wishing all the Sunny Side of Sports listeners all the best. Bye.
Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Yes, this is the Standard Side of Sports. And now for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Marco Ouma, who begins with football.
Morocco host Ghana in the Africa Women's FIFA Under-17 World Cup qualifier in Casablanca today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Nigeria welcomes South Africa as Cameroon encounter Ethiopia. In rugby news, South Africa plays Scotland as Kenya face Portugal at the start of their campaigns at the IRB 7 series in Vancouver, Canada tomorrow, Saturday. Seeded in Group C, South Africa will also face Brazil and Argentina, while Kenya engage Samoa and Fiji in other Group C preliminaries. At the start of this seventh leg in the nine-leg series, South Africa are second in the overall standings with 86 points. Kenya is eighth with 52 points and Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. Turning to athletics, the Africa Cross Country Championship takes place in Yaounde, Cameroon tomorrow, Saturday. Athletes are vying for honors in senior men's 10 kilometers, senior women's 8 kilometers, junior men's 10 kilometers, and junior women's 6 kilometers. One of South Africa's emerging talents, Glenrose Kaba, makes her debut at this continental event. Earlier on, I caught up with her while she was in training and asked her what she hopes to achieve when she competes in the senior women's 8 kilometers in Yaounde.
My aim this year is to come top 20 in the African cross country and qualify for the Olympics.
In which event?
In the Olympics.
I'm looking for 5,000 because coach said I must try 5,000 to qualify.
That was Glenrose Kaba, South African cross-country runner, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, the city of Tampere in Finland will stage the 2018 World Junior Athletics Championships, the World Athletics Governing Body, IAAF, revealed in Monaco on Thursday. The IAAF disclosed that the city of Valencia in Spain is venue for the 2018 World Half Marathon Championships, while the 2018 IAAF Continental Cup will be contested in Ostrava in the Czech Republic. And that's it. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. On the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
For it, and we answered. The Sunny Side of Sports is expanding our showtime on VOA Africa.
And in boxing, former world champion Floyd Mayweather has added the Ugandan boxer Sharif the Lion Bogere to his Mayweather promotions. The former Ugandan boxing national team captain inked a deal with the promotions company on Thursday. Mayweather told the media that they are proud to add another young, hungry fighter to their Mayweather promotion stable, describing Sharif Bogere as a very talented young man with an incredible backstory. On his part, Bogere said the move is an important one to his career and that he's eager to get back in the ring and show everybody why he's the future champion. Leonard Elbe, the chief executive officer of the company, arguably one of the biggest boxing promotion companies in the world, also says they have another future world champion in the Ugandan fighter and promise to get him the best fights on the biggest stage. Bogeri is one of Uganda's greatest exports in the sport, and his record stands at 28 fights with 27 wins, including 19 knockouts, and lost just once. The 27-year-old trains in Las Vegas with the legendary trainer Kenny Adams. He turned pro in 2008.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
The IAAF Council has decided the host cities for the 2018 IAAF World Athletics Series events. The decision was taken during the IAAF Council meeting on Thursday. Tampere in Finland will host the 2018 World Under-20 Championships. The Finnish city was the sole bidder and Council fully endorsed its bid to host this event. With Helsinki having twice staged the IAAF World Championships, this will be the first time that Finland has played host to an age group IAAF Championship event. Valencia in Spain will host the 2018 World Half Marathon Championship. 10 years after hosting the World Indoor Championships and 37 years after hosting the World Race Walking Cup, Valencia will stage its third World Athletics Series event. It will be the second time Spain has hosted the World Half Marathon Championships, 22 years after Palma de Mallorca staged the event. Now, for what's trending on social media, as usual, we turn to Andrew Palczewski. Hey, Andrew, what's trending now?
Hey, good to be with you. Well, in the U.S., we're talking about American football. We just had the Denver Broncos won the Super Bowl not too long ago, but already the football season is kind of sort of kicking off with a number of trades and transactions as players are moving off to different teams and getting cut from teams, getting picked up by other teams. And social media is playing an interesting role in this. I want to talk about one instance where you have Sean Smith, who is a free agent football player. He started following a number of players on the Oakland Raiders. This was before he had signed anywhere. So people were following him on Twitter, said, wait a minute, he's following all these new Oakland Raiders, maybe that's a sign that he's going to go to that team, and sure enough, he did. So social media and who he is following on Twitter actually told the story before he was even able to sign and before it was reported. So some very keen football watchers using social media to track that. And then you have his teammate, Bruce Irvin. He did something a little different. He started following a bunch of players from the Jacksonville Jaguars. So people said, oh, he must be going to Jacksonville. Well, sure enough, he went to the Oakland Raiders. So he faked everybody out on social media. So social media isn't always a perfect predictor, but it is something that people watch intently as these players make these decisions to try to see where they might end up and kind of tip their hand before they actually reveal which team they're going to.
And these players, most of these players are heavy social media users and with big followings.
Absolutely. And that's why social media tracking their moves has been such a big deal for a lot of fans, is because they're very active on social media. This is, in some cases, the first place they go to announce that they've gone to a new team or that they're leaving a team, is they go to social media. So that has become a huge outlet for this news for sports fans.
What else, Andrew, is trending?
Well, the big story out of the National Basketball Association is Kobe Bryant and LeBron James. Of course, Kobe Bryant is retiring this year, and so this was the last face-off between these two giants in the sport. Last night in Los Angeles, facing off, Kobe Bryant outscored LeBron James just barely, 26 points to 24. But a lot of people noting that there was a two-minute spurt where they were going back and forth. Kobe scored, then LeBron scored, then Kobe scored, back and forth and back and forth. And so a lot of people were very nostalgic and saying this is really the end of an era to see these two greats play on the same court. And at the end of the game, they hugged it out in center court and center of the arena there. So a lot of people commenting on that, saying it was a very nice moment, a lot of respect, even, you know, from LeBron fans for Kobe Bryant, saying that he's a great player and one that's going out after a really great career in the NBA.
Indeed, Kobe has had a very big mark, not only in the United States, but world over.
Oh, absolutely. Kobe and LeBron both. I mean, Kobe Bryant, because he's retiring, we're talking about him, has a huge Twitter following. But LeBron as well. I mean, these are names that are known around the world. And with their social media, they're kind of giving people an inside look into their lives. They're giving, as many players do, a look at what they do on the court, but also off the court as well. And so that's one of the things we've talked about this on the program in the past, that it's a way to connect fans with the players. You see them on TV or you hear them, you know, the games on the radio, but then you get to see kind of inside their lives. You get to see not just the moments that they're on the court, but then the before and after. So I think we're going to see, as Kobe Bryant works towards his retirement, a lot more of that. And especially even after he leaves the court for the last time, we're not going to hear the last from him. We're going to see things from him on social media. We're going to keep up with him on social media. So he'll be something that fans can still follow.
Oh, yes. Anything else, Andrew? Or that's all?
Well, more news on Maria Sharapova. We're waiting to see what the tennis anti-doping agency hands down as a punishment, and we'll have more on that next week. And also, the NCAA basketball tournament here in the U.S., the bracket set to be released this Sunday. Of course, March Madness, a huge deal in the U.S. and around the world, so we'll have more on that next week.
And plus, maybe the golf, the Masters are going, and maybe that should be another story to follow too.
Absolutely. Should be a big deal as well.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. And we'll be back again on Monday with more sports topics or events that are trending on social media. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Impulga. Sunny Young will be back on Monday. Now back to Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And Douglas will have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Sunny Music Entertainment opens a new office in Lagos. But first, some music. Here is Salif Keita from Mali with Yambo.
Yambo, 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 y
Mali's Salif Keita with Yambo.
In Nigeria, Sony Music Entertainment recently announced the opening of a new Lagos office, its first West African Sony office in decades. The move is intended to expand the company's Africa reach. Sean Watson, Africa Managing Director of Sony Music, tells Ricky Shryock they hope to innovate new mobile solutions to the music market as well as work with local artists.
We've been looking at Africa, or sub-Saharan Africa at least, from the South African company and, with our colleagues in Europe for about a good 5 years now, thinking of, what opportunity we should take to stretch our legs and re-enter some of the key markets. The obvious economic indicators in Africa as a frontier market and a growth opportunity was the big sort of signal way back that we should start doing this. The other thing then was the critical mass achieved by the mobile networks. When we saw what they were able to do as a distribution backbone, it also gave us a lot of hope.
When we talk about you guys opening up an office, what does that mean in real terms? Does that mean you'll be signing more local musicians? Or what does it mean you'll be looking at distributing all music from all over the world to a local market?
All of the above. Having not been in the market, and again, this is part of the reason why we need a local presence, is you can't exactly expect a local artist community to buy into your offering if you're not in their backyard. The first move would be that Sony represents millions of songs. Our first step would be to invest our catalog in that market. Out of that investment, the revenue that we generate then gets reinvested into artist development concurrently. But we don't expect that to be as immediate as the delivery of our international catalogue. Yes, we signed Davido, and off the back of that then, Michael's mandate and his brief is to work with the artistic community in Lagos to develop a model that we typically use to invest in local repertoire and develop the local artist and community. Nigeria has developed, you know, since the major record companies exited, you know, over a decade ago, has developed its own system. It's quite different to the rest of the world. So the other thing for us was obviously not to just impose ourselves. What we'd rather do is try and integrate how we do things with the way things are done on the ground.
Is there any kind of excitement about the fact that there is an ingenuity to West Africa when it comes to these things? They figure out a solution, and it might be a solution that nobody thought about. And the mobile saturation is so large in some of these markets as well.
Personally, that's probably what I'm most excited about, is the innovation in Africa around mobile. I think, you know, African success stories lead the innovation in the mobile world. When you think of products like M-Pesa, which is mobile banking.
How exciting, I feel like, is it to be in West Africa where music is just so integral to everything?
Well, you know, what we've seen is that the two pillars of any proud, upstanding African community are music and football. It's almost a perfect marketplace when you think of how important music is. But it's now obviously making sure that it's accessible and affordable based on the resource that the African community has to access music. And that's our challenge, is how we, you know, reverse engineering European and US models to make them feasible and so that we can integrate them in Africa may not be the right approach. It may be somewhere along the line. We are reverse engineering what we have, but we're also meeting a grassroots up development story and where those two connect.
That was Sean Watson, Africa Managing Director of Sony Music Entertainment. He spoke with Ricky Shryock from Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Saif al-Adel is a fugitive and suspected high-ranking member of the Al-Qaeda terror network who was wanted in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. He is an Egyptian citizen with black hair and dark eyes. He is also believed to be affiliated with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. He is also known as Ibrahim al-Madani and Muhammad Ibrahim Makawi. Hundreds of people were killed in the embassy attacks and thousands wounded, most Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens. 12 Americans died. For these and other acts, al-Adel is charged with murder, conspiracy to destroy United States property, and other crimes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Adel's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Music Time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.